A previously niche academic theory designed to highlight how the history, structure, and practices of key American institutions are inherently racist, critical race theory, seems to have gone mainstream. The political right, both in the US and the UK, have contributed to its moment of fame, perhaps even more than its supporters. In the US, Republican politicians like Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem have spoken publicly against it. And some have even put forward bills that try to make the teaching of critical race theory illegal. In the UK, the Conservative MP, Kemi Badenoch, said in Parliament, "I want to be absolutely clear that the government stands unequivocally against critical race theory. We do not want teachers to teach their white pupils about white privilege and inherited racial guilt." So why is the political right so riled up about critical race theory? And what does the theory itself actually claim? Has critical race theory simply become an umbrella term for all discourse to do with race and racism? And if so, are the accounts of racism as a systemic issue a watered-down account of critical race theory's more radical critique and diagnosis of the sources of racism? Welcome to The Philosopher and the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. This week, I'm delighted to have as my guest, Tommy Curry. He holds a personal chair in Africana philosophy and black male studies at the University of Edinburgh. And in 2018, he won an American Book Award for The Man Not, Race, Class, Gender, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood. As you will hear, Curry pulls no punches in his account of how critical race theory has been gentrified by institutional philosophy and has purposely forgotten its more radical roots in the work of people like Derek Bell, who proclaimed that racism is permanent and that black people will never gain full equality in this country. Critical race theory might be portrayed in the media as something only the right finds uncomfortable, but Tommy Curry's words will challenge even those who see themselves as allies of black people in the fight against racism. Tommy Curry, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
So today I want to talk about, as you know, critical race theory. And I wanted to kick it off by asking you, what do you make of the fact that it has now, in some way, in some version of it, entered the mainstream and is being used by conservative politicians, both in the US and in the UK, to paint those who, you know, associate with it as dangerous radicals who undermine any progress made against racism in the recent past? And what do you think it is also about critical race theory that Republicans in the US and conservatives in the UK, since you have the experience of living in both countries, really fear in relation to critical race theory? Why do they get so worked up about it?
I mean, for years, when I was in the United States, I said this was inevitably coming. I thought the attacks on academics, especially black male academics and black radicals like Marxists, who were making systematic critiques about the failure of integration, the symbolism of Donald Trump not merely being an accident, but inevitable backlash to what people perceive as the progress by Obama, and the presence of the alt-right on U.S. college campuses. Those three things really culminated into what I saw as a movement to take back the central and the right in America saw as losing America. And I think that what happened is critical race theory, because it takes such a strong stance on the permanence of racism, the inevitability of racism, the unchanging but still dynamic nature of white supremacy, it doesn't allow America to move beyond that stain, so to speak. So in order to stamp out progressive leftist movements, even though they're not black radical movements like critical race theory, because black people have always influenced the left in some respect, I think the right sees critical race theory as being a fundamental idea that it has to crush in order to destroy the idea that America and ultimately white people are without virtue and without the possibility of positive change. Critical race theory, you know, one of my papers I talk about is becoming as interchangeable for thinking about race as Kleenex, like tissue and Kleenex, right? And the reason for that is because, like anything, when it becomes mainstream, it loses its kind of caustic nature. It's powerful bite against institutions. Yep. And what ends up happening with critical race theory is you have a Black radical tradition by people like Derrick Bell, Richard Delgado, on the early Kimberlé Crenshaw, when she's writing Race and Retrenchment, Linda Green, you know, these scholars who are trying to say, look, racism, colonialism is a permanent aspect of how America's legal and social structure is created, and the economic structure that enforces these kinds of ideas. Over time, now critical race theory becomes something that can be transformative, multicultural. You can read Derrida, Kant, etc. Those were not the intellectual progenitors of critical race theory. They're reading Du Bois. They're reading Frantz Fanon, the Black Panthers, right? X. Because what they see is that America constantly utilizes every form of inequality to build up racial stratifications within society. And this is why you have Derrick Bell saying something like racism is permanent. Many academics don't believe that now, because the idea that racism is permanent, that society won't change, that legal and liberal recognition of rights and identity is not the way to solve inequality or racism or discrimination, doesn't fit with the kind of woke-tivism that's being sold as the dominant kind of contemporary wave of good leftist politics. So there's a tension between that radicality and the reformism, and the right understands that.
I mean, you've already touched on the fact that, you know, why the question, what is critical race theory, is not at all straightforward, and there are different understandings of it. Maybe we can sort of start at the beginning, as it were, and think a little bit about what the origins of critical race theory are, and, you know, who first put it forward, and what was the purpose of it when that took place?
Yeah, so, I mean, here's what's interesting, is that I think there are different interpretations about the origin. I mean, if you read the key book of writings, you talk to Derrick Bell, you know, about the origins of this before he passed. You know, he's very clear that he was writing about this stuff in the 1970s. So he has this article that was published, I think, in Notre Dame Law Review, Racial Remediation, where he's writing about critical race theory and the failure of integration and Brown v. Board while white scholars are talking about critical legal studies. You know, I think the genealogies that you get in textbooks is something like, or the founding of critical race theory was in part a reaction to critical legal studies, you know, focusing on more abstract things like Pierre Schlag's work and the issue of legal normativity, or even, you know, Tushnet and rights-based criticisms that said that rights were always there to protect the power of the privilege. And critical race theorists and Black lawyers were like, well, these are instruments we can use to gain some power and protection back. And that sure is partially true, but I think there's an intellectual genealogy here that also shows that, well, you know, you have people like Derrick Bell working with Black lawyers like Robert L. Carter and Thurgood Marshall, right? That's in that intellectual genealogy when Black lawyers are trying to figure out why is it that desegregation, and when that becomes known as integration, fails to actually remedy and improve the lives and conditions of Black people. So this is what he creates, you know, understands it's kind of the interest convergence to learn, right? That you have Black clients that he's defending that are being desegregated from Southern schools, but they're not benefiting. The state's not enforcing this, right? So he's like, what is it that's generating this kind of lackadaisical thinking and action on behalf of Black people, despite there being Supreme Court law or decision that justifies this? So I'm more interested in my research and looking at how critical race theory develops through this Black intellectual genealogy. So how are Black lawyers specifically looking at the failure of Brown v. Board of Education, tying it to issues of communism and anti-communism that's driving it, where this is not a watershed moment in American race relations, and how from those failures, they're starting to develop a different train of thought. So if Brown v. Board doesn't become this watershed civil rights moment, it's only a way in many ways to extend American imperialism and white supremacy throughout the globe, then how do Black people think differently about the mainstream civil rights narrative that we've been given out of the 1960s and 70s? And I think this is why Bell's thinking is so important, because what it's asking us to do is say, well, look, if critical race theory is about recognizing the failure of liberalism and the impossibility of inequality, then what is the purpose of struggle? How do we think about the world as Black people, as brown folk, as oppressed racial minorities? So when we think about critical race theory, we're thinking about an interdisciplinary paradigm, so to speak, that's trying to understand how the failure of liberal values or civil rights, so equality, integration, you know, the Warren Court's idea of contact theory that it's getting from Alport. Mm-hmm. If these notions, if these theories fail, what do Black people have? What do brown folks have? What do Indigenous people have? That's what critical race theory is trying to investigate. So it's an area of thought that doesn't just start with the assumption that racism is permanent, but reaches that through a conclusion of analyzing the economic, political, and legal landscape of America, and then how we should think about that if we take away the illusion of equality, democracy, and actual integration of Blacks and other racial minorities.
What is it about integration that is problematic? Because this is, as you say, the origins of critical race theory, and some of the originators find this idea of integration to be, as you say, superficial, a politically expedient way to usurp the domestic power of Black radicals. So, A, can you remind us a little bit about the context of Brown versus Board of Education, for those at least who aren't US-based? And also tell us a little bit about why was it that critical race theorists at the time saw this as problematic, right? And this kind of integration that was being pursued as superficial and ultimately, as you say, in the economic and political interests of white people and not Black people.
Absolutely. So I think the earliest way or the easiest way to talk about it is from Plessy v. Ferguson. The idea of Plessy v. Ferguson was that segregation was legal because you could be separate but equal. Mm-hmm. Brown v. Board of Education was a school case against the school board, showing that separate but equal educational facilities in the United States, specifically amongst primary age children, primary school, almost never equal. So for some people may have heard about the Kenneth Clark study. What ended up happening mm-hmm. was that they used this as evidence to show that segregation ultimately brought about an inferiority complex amongst Black children, and that ultimately wasn't equal. That on top of issues of textbooks, access, teachers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this goes to the Supreme Court, all the way to the Supreme Court and the Warren Court. And Warren concludes that, yeah, you know, segregation is in fact can never be equal. And what's interesting about the Warren Court's decision is that that's really framed the intellectual discussion and discourse around how we view race relations, even the academy. So the Supreme Court says segregation can never be equal. So the way that we evaluate race consciousness or racial critique is we constantly attack Black people and other racial minorities anytime they want to segregate, right? So it's a really interesting connection between what the Warren Court said in the 1950s and how we actually understand politics and intellectual trends now. Because if you have Black people that say, this is never going to work, we should have separate X, Y, and Z, in an academy, you automatically attack those people as being nationalists, militants, racist, and essentialist, right? But we accept that kind of idea when we're talking about things like gender, right? We don't have a problem with gender separation because we assume that men are a danger to women. So women and men should have different spaces. But when you apply that same kind of reasoning to white people and Black people, despite the fact that white people have historically lynched, murdered, raped, and maimed Black folk, we don't understand white people as being opposing that same kind of danger to Black society. And that's a very, very big issue because what's being contended with in Brown v. Board of Education, as well as segregation and desegregation, is really a litmus test of social violence. Because the ways that whites resisted desegregation by the Warren Court, so the way they resisted Brown v. Board was through racial intimidation and through murder. So Black civil rights workers were killed. Black militants were killed. King was killed. X was killed, right? But most of the people that we look at as heroes are all paid for civil rights with their lives. So when we're talking about Brown v. Board of Education, we're not just talking about the decision. We're talking about the motivating factors and what was happening on the ground when civil rights workers and lawyers were trying to actually desegregate states and schools and localities after the decision. A few years later, and we could actually see this in the writing of someone like W.E.B. Du Bois, like in the late 1960s, he's actually discussing how Brown v. Board of Education was actually not an issue about solving racism in America, but really an issue about winning the Cold War. One of the stains, so to speak, on American democracy was the Negro problem. And you heard Black soldiers that were fighting in places like Vietnam and you know places in the former Soviet Union were constantly showing that communism was a superior economic and political system precisely because it didn't try to alienate the Negro. So you had lots of Black people like Du Bois, Paul Robeson, actually championing communism and socialism as a better system for Black people worldwide understanding that because capitalism was built on slavery, the disposability of the Black body, that was never going to be able to incorporate or accommodate Black people in American society. What I think is most important about this history, however, is that we have to understand that we've been taught a very specific narrative about race and racism in the United States, one that takes white people as being ever-changing and capable of thinking through problems of race as they do other social problems. Very much so because of the language of the left, we see racism as being analogous to any other form of discrimination, be it sex discrimination or gender or sexual orientation discrimination, and now, of course, you know, trans discrimination. Mm-hmm. And that's just fundamentally untrue. The way that racism evolved, you know, just throughout history has always been about the extermination of mass populations. We don't have a problem admitting this when we're talking about Jewish or Armenian populations, because we understand those white ethnicities as been suffering some of the most horrible atrocities the world has ever known. But when we flip that back to Black people and ask questions about colonialism and enslavement and Jim Crow segregation, where people are being mutilated and Black men are being castrated, we don't associate that with an atrocity against the very integrity of the human soul. So Brown v. Board is thought of symbolically as America moving forward, despite the fact that you have government organized raids and destructions of Black citizens of rights and their lives. You have this kind of government intervention to actually destroy Black civil rights movements. But we don't talk about any of that. So we've really whitewashed history because we look at Brown v. Board as a watershed moment of change, even though there were difficulties, but we don't see how it ignited all kind of extra state and international backlashes to contain the Negro problem and really put a veneer over what American democracy can do in relationship to race compared to communist states.
Let's get into your key thesis that critical race theory has actually been distorted, watered down, gentrified, if you like, within academia in a way that ignores its origins and has taken away a lot of the original bite that critical race theory had. And you say, Black theory, and I'm quoting you here, Black theory is canonized by the extent to which its founding authors are displaced and the particularity of its methods and concepts assimilated within the disciplinary narratives of the larger canon, end quote.
Absolutely.
And in particular, you contrast this kind of racial realist approach of people like Derek Bell with what you call the idealist approach of much contemporary critical race theory. So can you tell us a little bit more explicitly about the differences between this kind of critical race theory of the realist approach and the contemporary, as it were, version in the academy, the idealist, as it were, interpretation?
Realists are materialists. They're interested in what's happening economically, politically, and sociologically about race in the society. So a critical race theorist would look at something like police shootings and concrete level ask, what's the political motivations? How does this practice function to build up racism or white supremacy in the society? Why does it specifically target racialized men at such a disproportionate rate compared to their female counterparts? The discursive or idealist camp would be more interested in the discourse, the representation, the unconscious bias. So it's big into psychoanalysis. It would look into those things to investigate the problem and often rely on something like coalitional logics or some form of reformism or recognition to address the problem, whereas the racial realists would say that those are band-aids at best and they're never actually going to solve the issue. So we need to understand and diagnose why the issue persists and what it's being utilized for.
Yeah, and it's very, as you say, very radical in its kind of original outlook. And there is this powerful quote by Derek Bell: Black people will never gain full equality in this country. Even those Herculean efforts we hail as successful will produce no more than temporary peaks of progress, short-lived victories that slide into irrelevance as racial patterns adapt in ways that maintain white dominance. So I know you argue in your work that, you know, there's an over-focus in some ways in these quotations, and it ends up with a quite reductive understanding of Derek Bell's thought. But the power of these quotations kind of make it hard to look away, as it were. And I guess one of the critiques is that, as you say, this is too pessimistic a framework. It paves the way to a kind of nihilism, the idea that, you know, all efforts to eradicate racism are in vain if it's, you know, something that's just kind of always going to be with us. So is this critique misplaced in your opinion, and why is that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And because I never understood why nihilism is a criticism. For the life of me, I can't understand it. You know, if you tell a cancer patient they have 6 months to live and they go out and live the best life they can in 6 months, nobody says that that's a fatalist or nihilistic position, because even though you know the terminology of the disease, there's an influx of values and new meaning and fulfillment before that time ends. But when you talk about Black people, we either have to believe the lies that one day we will become equal despite the evidence to the contrary, or if you believe you won't become equal, then allegedly Black people have no intellectual or value-based or axiomatic resources. They're all going to jump on a bridge and do nothing. It's nonsense, right? It's nonsense. And this is what I mean, is that you have whole traditions of Italian philosophers that talk about nihilism, right, as a political posture. There's a certain kind of nihilism in chronopolitics literature. There's a certain nihilism that evolves from the work of Nietzsche, right? We celebrate these thinkers. But Black people, specifically Black men like Derrick Bell, says that racism is permanent. And the only way that we could think about this is that Black people will ultimately be defeated, right? And again, part of my criticism about why I think this is such a bastardization of Black thought is that it doesn't even rise to the level of critical engagement that we give to every other white thinker that we've done within the Western tradition. And when people have not found a way out, like Heidegger, who turns to Nazism, we still give those people a serious read. Despite the claim, nobody's read, besides from me and maybe a few other people, you know, Tim Golden, Jessica Akron, I don't know a lot of people that is actually reading Derrick Bell in philosophy. And again, this says something so deeply about the racist structure of philosophy, that you could have a whole discipline that advertises people who do critical race theory, and not one job been asked to either write for or seen myself in the field requires anyone to know anything about the foundational authors. And this is why I said that critical race theory is used interchangeably, like Kleenex is for tissue, because the idea is that we have people talking about race, even if they don't have any classes. This is the important part. When I wrote the article on the underspecialization of race theory in American philosophy, I asked very specific questions. If you could come out in continental philosophy, the assumption is that you have at least 9 to 12 hours in some continental figures or traditions. Right. Nobody pops up and says, I took one class in Nietzsche, I do continental philosophy. Right. But when you're studying Black people, it is not uncommon for you to find candidates competing for jobs where they just took an independent study with someone and claiming that they're a specialist in race. So when you have that kind of under specialization, awarding people research one positions without any knowledge of race or race theory whatsoever, ultimately it keeps pushing the conversation down. So that people who are having conversations about Delgado's Chronicles or Derrick Bell's Afrolantica or Kenneth Nunn's theory of law as a Eurocentric enterprise don't ever get to truly have both an intellectual community or an acceptance, because white people in philosophy, white liberals, are going to pick the less radical thought to be more comfortable with. Because critical race theory is such a radical discipline, radical set of assumptions, radical empirical set of observational characteristics about the law, economics, and politics, there's a way in which it's being discouraged and the labels being taken, but none of the foundational texts are. I just simply can't think of a counterexample where you can have someone saying that they do continental philosophy, but have never, you know, or the phenomenology and existentialism, but have never read like Heidegger or Nietzsche or any of these figures. But we could do that with critical race theory.
Yeah, I totally take your point. And you do say in one of your essays that, you know, again, quite bold claim that philosophy is a sort of racist institution, at least the way in which we kind of practice it in the West at the moment, and the States and the UK.
Oh, yeah. I'm completely willing to defend that empirically.
So, okay. I mean, maybe we don't want to explain it away in any way, but I heard you say earlier that in some ways critical race theory doesn't get a fair hearing in philosophy because the way philosophy has developed, at least in the West, again, the way we do it here, is just a bit resistant to those kind of tools, the kind of more historical, more empirical type of research. You know, sure, we like to read books, but, you know, less so to kind of go out and do kind of primary research or kind of refer to it so much. So is that one explanation about why critical race theory, at least in kind of your conception of it and then the conception of people like Derrick Bell, hasn't really taken off? Or is the reason, as you see it, more the idea that, well, that's just too radical, too political, too uncomfortable for the people that occupy those institutions to really be able to seriously engage with them? Or is it both?
I mean, I think it's both, but let's work with the example, right? Like George Herbert Mead and John Dewey were educationalists and social psychologists, but we still read them in American philosophy as insightful philosophers and pragmatists. Mm-hmm. So we had no problem with the University of Chicago developing sociology around Albion Small in 1900 and basically reading the Chicago School as the birthplace of American pragmatism. We did the same thing with Jane Addams. She was doing social work, right? She's heralded as one of the founders of American social work because she's down with the people in neighborhoods. But we can't do the same for Black lawyers who are fighting for civil rights. That seems some sort of, that's a little ironic, right? See, we pick and choose who we want to put in the canon, and then we use the question of praxis or practicality or being on the ground as a way to dismiss them as philosophers. Well, we make great exception for any of the white philosophers that have done the same thing, because then we say that their applied philosophy or applied ethics gives us greater insight into the philosophical potential that abstract thinking has for the real world. But even if I'm willing to concede that point, I think there's an even more powerful point to make. Well, let's say that philosophers were interested in philosophical exegesis, which is what we generally are trained in American and continental philosophy. Well, then what is it then that differentiates the kind of thinking that we see throughout the text of someone like a John Dewey or Josiah Royce or Joseph LeCant, or, you know, pick any of the people that are writing American philosophy at the turn of the century, and their blatant racism, right? Or even take, you know, the feminists, right? The suffragists, just blatant racism. You know, people like Charlotte Gilman, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, right? Susan B. Anthony, you know, Phoebe Cousins. You know, we go day in and day out on it. So you have all these white theorists, Jane Addams, all these white theorists who are in conversation with various forms of American philosophy. Okay, you have Heidegger and his Nazism. You have, you know, Schelling and all the and Schiller, right? All these people who are completely anti-Black and racist, one way or the other. But those thoughts don't ever get centered or introduced, even though they're part of their canon and would be part of the text examined for more deep exegesis and evaluation, right? So then I have to ask the question, right? So we're asking the plain out question: why does philosophy not engage these issues? Well, these are in the text. These are in the text of the figures that they study. So who's making the decision that those texts on geography in Kant, for instance, are less important than his questions on the Third Critique about judgment? Who's making the questions about the practical morality, right, being, or the practical philosophy being philosophical, but the questions about how he implements the pragmatic questions of freedom in the anthropology less philosophical? You see, there's a selection bias in the way that white people have historically constructed the canon. Like, even let's talk about the wokeism or the thing we can never talk about, like feminism. How is it that you have literally 150 years of white women making racist texts saying their whole purpose is to destroy the Negro man? And somehow nobody in philosophy knows about any of this. And it's published in the Revolution. It's published in the same books that we're pulling all the other feminist thinking and thought from. It's written in books like The Second Assault in the 1970s. Who's being quoted by people like bell hooks and Kimberly Crenshaw? Like, we have all the evidence that there's a long historical tradition of racism and pragmatism because it's based on evolutionary theory and psychology and recapitulation and feminism and liberalism, right? It's all there. But somehow philosophy, even though we're supposed to be good thinkers and textual readers, somehow keeps missing it. So the question really isn't whether or not there's an approach that's being prioritized. Is it too empirical versus theoretical or abstract? The very question of what we select to read and how we exclude those things that give light to the kinds of anti-Black racism, genocidal logics, anti-Semitism, et cetera, that are present throughout the Western philosophical canon is evidence that the canon is being constructed in a very particular sort of way.
You're listening to The Philosopher and the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. As always, this podcast is created in partnership with The Philosopher, the UK's longest-running public philosophy journal. The spring issue of The Philosopher is out, investigating the relationship between authority and knowledge, with essays by Heidi Graswick on oppression and the authority of science, Ian James Kidd on character, vices, and authority, and Federico Brandmeier on Social Scientists, a New Priestly Caste. To get your hands on a copy, go to www.thephilosopher1923.org. That is thephilosopher1923.org. Can we return to this idea of ideals versus kind of looking at the real socioeconomic realities. And again, you know, this is one of the things you highlight in Derek Bell's racial realism thought.
Yes, absolutely.
One is this kind of historical, as you say, methodology of looking at the context, looking at the history. The other is looking at the economics, putting an emphasis on kind of material reality. And it isn't just putting an emphasis on that. It's also saying that, well, we shouldn't allow ideals to kind of, Bell says, to obscure the Black's real position in the socioeconomic realm, which happens to be the real indicator of power in this country, he says.
Mm-hmm.
So this is another question about why maybe critical race theory has had a hard time, at least that version of it, because it seems to go against this narrative when it comes to the civil rights movement, which is that it was exactly this kind of focus on, you know, the founding ideals of the United States, like equality or whatever, liberty, and the idea that we could demonstrate that the country was failing short of embodying those ideals, and therefore, you know, something had to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the standard story, if you like, about, you know, Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. So is this one of the other kind of blockages that we face when it comes to appreciating critical race theory?
Yeah, this is what I meant, that is a paradigmatic issue rather than one simply of filling in the gaps of history or narrative, right? People read King suggesting that he was in fact trying to fulfill the aims of American civil rights, and that's just not true. King saw American civil rights as part of a global struggle for civil rights and human rights, which is why he was against colonialism and capitalism and the development of military technology to harm people that lived in the third world, in quotes, right? You know, so again, this is what I mean. Black thinkers are so much more dynamic and have much richer depths of analysis that they get pictured for in philosophy. Most people read King's letter in Birmingham jail because it fits the narrative. Oh, look, he's pointing out that integration's failing and he's willing to do this just thing like, you know, Plato and Socrates in the cave and da-da-da-da-da. And that's nice and all, but that's not what King was doing, right? King was having debates with other Black thinkers in the SNCC. He was debating Stokely Carmichael over the meaning of Black power. He was debating and criticizing France Fanon's, quote, you know, ideas of revolutionary violence in Algeria and Africa, et cetera, because he's invested in trying to develop a kind of thinking that allows for a revolution of values that would stop violence altogether. But those are not the kinds of conversations we're debating in philosophy about King, because the narrative constrains and underspecializes and underdevelops what the considerations for a Black philosopher and thinker can actually be. As I've said before in my previous research, the way that we design or designate Black philosophical figures is based on who agrees with white people. There's not a single Black figure today. And I think this is, I can demonstrate this so succinctly with Du Bois. There's not a Black thinker today that we read at the end of their lives. Right. So if you look at the work that's done around W.E.B. Du Bois, and this is what's so interesting to me, given the way that we approach white thinkers. White thinkers are discussed throughout periods of life, right? The early Foucault, the late Foucault in the 1970s, you know, society must be defended and forward, where he's thinking about neoliberalism, except like there's a maturation in white thought that we never get in Black thought. And the reason for that is because when Black people are younger, right? So when Du Bois is writing in the late 19th century, 1890s, et cetera, he has some hope, right? He thinks that reason and all the stuff he learned about economics in Berlin could change things. By the 1920s, he's separatist, basically. He's writing children's books. He's saying that white people are fundamentally racist. We have to work in our own racial development. By the 1960s, he thinks that white people are the most deceitful and conniving race that ever existed, and there is no reconciliation with them, then American democracy is completely unworkable. Now, there is practically no philosophy department in the United States that reads any of the texts of Du Bois from 1940 forward. At best, they stop at Dark Water, which is 1920. And the reason for that is because what you see systematic, it's the same reason we don't teach King's last book, Where Do We Go From Here, or his essays on Black power, right? Because at the end of their lives, they recognize despite their efforts, nothing mattered and racism is still the same. Now, I ask you, what white figure have we completely disregarded and failed to write about their later works? The whole resurgence of Kant around the Third Critique in Anthropology was questioning whether or not there was a mature Kant there. Was there something that's been missed that reflects differently on the critical
philosophy, right? So it's not just a hermeneutical question. It's a question of how we prioritize and create a historiography of philosophical interpretation. We applaud white scholars for doing such work. We applaud the way that we are able to reinvigorate debates about white texts and figures in such a way in continental American philosophy. But when you do that to a black figure, then the whole question becomes that's not philosophy, that's politics, that's ideology. Mm-hmm. But the minute that you violate the paradigmatic assumption of civil rights creating gains, it becomes more like militancy or nationalist ideology. But we don't hold the same thing for gender theories. We read all kinds. We're still reading people like Catherine McKinnon, and she holds a bioessential account of the notions of man and woman, specifically around the issue of rape. But we find that, even though it was written in the 70s and 80s, to be useful. We're talking about black people who all these histories show were fungible, malleable, attacked by the state, had different kinds of actual involvements in civil rights. We don't see any of this as being interesting and demanding a real rethinking of how we tell the historical narrative. Right? And that's why I argue in my own work, right, that the under-specialization of race theory in American philosophy, specifically American philosophy and the continental tradition, ultimately aims to censor and de-radicalize the potential of black thought. It's not about one specific ideology. Rather, it's about constraining and trimming down black intellectual traditions to fit within pragmatism. It's nonsense for us to even talk about Du Bois being a pragmatist. He has a letter that he wrote to Aptheker saying that he wasn't a pragmatist, right? But notice what we do. Because the discipline demands that we interpret him in a way that's relevant to white thinking and theory, we have to read him as a pragmatist. There are people who are reading Du Bois as an integrationist or multiculturalist when he was against integration. He literally wrote that it was racial suicide, that integrating the schools would destroy the culture of black people, they would forget Africa, and they would forget themselves, aiming to be white people. Yet all these papers get published in philosophy, in white journals for white reviewers that praise the idea that we can read black thinkers in such a way, despite the black thinkers themselves resisting such a reading. And no one says a word about it because we don't debate what black thinkers say. We debate how black thinkers are used. So critical race theory is a paradigmatic grounding, so to speak, that's pulling black thinkers towards that pessimism, towards what philosophy thinks is literally nationalist militancy and political ideology. So the rejection of critical race theory, both in the discipline and society at large, is not about the arguments it's making. It's about the gravity that it has to turn black thinking towards the more realistic vein that sees and uncovers both the American society and the disciplinary traditions and practices of the U.S. Academy for what it is, which is the maintenance of white power.
Can I ask you a question about the value of equality? So you have this, again, very powerful quote. You say equality only serves as an imaginative allure, a fantasy, and this is the reality that must be conceptually disengaged. The demand for equality is a request to be recognized as rational, as individuals, ahistorical, and of course, as unblackened by whites. Mm-hmm. It's a very powerful quote. And I understand, you know, coming from, you know, the canon that I am more familiar with, I can understand to some extent this worry that the power of a universal concept like equality, you know, erases particularity. This is a worry that Adorno, for example, expresses. And it writes over the individual experiences of people that are very different and, you know, have very different histories and very different lives. But is there a worry that if we give up these ideals, even if they are misguided, even if they are to some extent, you know, erasing of difference, and maybe we don't want to do that, what do we have to then aspire to? What are the new ideals that we can kind of replace if those are ideals that haven't worked, mm-hmm. and that in some ways are counterproductive? What are the kind of alternatives that we can turn mm-hmm. to?
Well, why can't we create situational values, right? So if I may riff off of a critical theory reference to Adorno, what would be the difference of the subject reclaiming themselves from if we're reading Althusser, for instance? How does the subject define themselves as a subject that's not already predetermined by ideology? Because that's fundamentally the question that we're asking, right? We have a notion of equality because that creates the basis for which we understand subjects operating and playing in within various nations and states. But in doing so, we've already mm-hmm. constrained a subject, so to speak, so that there's already a necessary repression before the subject even begins living. But for Black people, that's especially insidious because it means that in a world where you're constantly being killed and pressured and repressed by racism, that you're believing in a fantasy. So how then do we create something different? How do we rupture the system, so to speak, if you don't look at the critical theory, rupture idea? And I think this is where Derek Bell gets his notion of struggle and Afro-Atlantica, right? Bell thinks that struggle against oppression creates positive values. And these don't have to be universal. So coming from what we would call an existential phenomenological approach, he would think that values are being created through the becoming and actual living and transformation of Black people and Black bodies. He's largely getting this from his understanding of Paul Robeson's poetry and how Paul Robeson imagines Black people as world citizens. So Afrolantica, which is a fictional island that only Black Americans can kind of see and breathe on and feel free and energized are, is an example of that kind of fleeting view of new values and a new state and a new reality that Black people can see because of their suffering, but hasn't yet arrived, right? I think that's the same way that we would think of any of the notions of equality that we see, or even, you know, and even in the more negative sense, like these are some of the same kinds of arguments we see with, you know, Zionism or other diasporic imaginings of people's ultimate purpose, though this one's actually liberatory, right? So very clear distinction, though. I think that those can be useful for oppressed people. I don't see oppressed people having to appeal to some universal norm that's created and sustained by the structures that oppress them to be the basis of liberation. And I understand that's what we've done in liberal thinking and liberal thought, which is why it's a very powerful idea, right? We can say, well, we have these values, right? And of course, this fits with how we read Western philosophy, right? You know, when Socrates is asked, well, give me an example of, or give me a definition of justice versus example, right? And people say, oh, well, you're just saying you want a particular, which is merely an example, right, of equality in this X case at this time versus this meeting this formal definition. But if in a world, and again, this is why I think it's imperative for us to understand the limitation of ideal theory, in a world where equality is constantly invalidated, right, and the living and experience of the rational being or subject has always been subhuman, right? So you can think about Charles Mills' essay on Cartesian sums here, for example. Then how do you create values where this particular kind of subhuman subject can have access to reason and the ideal, right? I've been constructed in such a way because of history where those things are beyond me. So to suggest that I simply have them automatically and history played no part, that I'm analogous to white people, to white men and women, where I can be a free being, is just as unreal. It's just as abstract. It's just as fanciful. So I think that what inevitably happens is we have to look at more particular and situational understandings of how groups are creating values. And just as Derrida says, when we're talking about logocentrism, we're not talking about any actual universal character. We're just talking about stuff that white people made up and said was reason. So I think that understanding the mythology of reason and the universal is imperative to understanding the particularities of oppressed people who are also engaging in the same kind of mythological process that has the same kind of basis for both their historicity and their process and struggles for liberation.
I mean, sometimes when you kind of critique the way that the critical race theory has been absorbed by, you know, white institutions or white scholars, almost sounds like you think it's just impossible in some way for, you know, white people to A, fully appreciate and understand what racism means for Black people. Mm-hmm. So to really engage with these particular stories, or even if they do engage, to really kind of understand them. So do you think there is a possibility of doing that? So I did an episode with, you know, Elizabeth Anderson a while back, and we were talking about it, these divisions in a different context and political divisions and how people's experiences in the United States have kind of diverged in such ways that, you know, it's becoming increasingly impossible for people, say, who live in urban educated neighborhoods to have an understanding of what life is for someone who lives in a rural town in the middle of nowhere in some place they will never visit. And she was arguing that, look, you know, you can maybe do it by exchanging stories about your lives, by kind of trying to empathize with people and understand their circumstances and so on. I was wondering, and I don't know how to phrase this without it, maybe, I don't know, sounding kind of naive on my side maybe, but I was talking about how you, in your writings, think that, or argue quite convincingly that, you know, white people in positions of power in universities and other institutions, research institutions, have sort of failed despite the fact that, you know, their politics, at least on paper, should make them more sensitive and more open to understanding kind of the experience of Black people, or to be sympathetic to the phenomenon of racism. You know, they failed to do that, as you argue. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to see whether there is a similar way to the one that, you know, Elizabeth Anderson talks about when it comes to overcoming different types of divisions between urban populations and rural populations, or, you know, people who are Republicans and only live in a diet of, you know, Fox News and other kind of even more polarizing online media, like, I don't know, InfoWars or whatever, and, you know, the liberals living on the coast, reading the New York Times and the Atlantic and other publications. And she was arguing that, well, there is a way to, you know, get these people back together and start talking to each other and understanding each other by talking about their particular experiences and their stories, and, you know, and then you can kind of begin to create some kind of empathy between people and some kind of level of understanding. And I was wondering whether you think, given that we were talking about how, you know, we need to go back to the particulars, back to particular contexts and back to individuals' histories, whether doing that will enable, in your opinion, a kind of greater understanding on the side of white people of the Black experience, or whether you're too pessimistic about that and think that that's not actually a possibility.
What has that idea ever worked? I mean, Elizabeth Anderson's book on imperative integration is based on airports contact theory, the idea that interactions with different groups of people transfer into different experiences and empathies. We know that with race specifically Black men, that's not true. Every modern finding we have about contact with Black men is they trigger fight or flight responses in white men. They actually increase white women's demand for sexism because they want white men to protect them from outgroup men. You know, it's, again, this is why I think it's the standard. If Anderson can get away with saying those kinds of things because there it feeds into a belief. Alport's contact theory has been long empirically denied on issues of race, the last 20 or 30 years, by Black psychologists. But in her book, she doesn't quote a single Black psychologist or criticism of Alport's contact theory. So how do we understand the basis of the thinking? The system, the discipline says that's a fantastic idea because we're all integrations. It's the bad Black people who doubt that integration is the way forward. But then when you read her book, for instance, I actually write about this in an article that I just got published in the Aristotelian Society, where I ask very simple questions. So Anderson makes the argument that, you know, segregation produces Black men and brown men who have these street attitudes, and that prevents them from getting jobs. But over and over again, we find out that even Black people who are educated in Ivy League institutions that are competing for CEO jobs, Black men are still saw as threatening, which is why they should have a baby face or crack jokes. So her optimism is based in the negation of the empirical and scientific realities that we have that explain the kinds of things she wants to explain. Black men aren't being unemployed because they have street attitudes. Black men have a higher rate of unemployment because white people are scared of them. They're incarcerated because white women in particular form a proxemic gauge for how the white race responds to outgroup men, which is why issues of criminality and rapes, as said by Donald Trump, resonated so deeply with his white female base. And they, in both elections, voted overwhelmingly for him. It's easy for us to say that we can bridge gaps if we don't have to actually look at evidence. And that's the burden. There are roughly 7,000 white women in philosophy. She has an audience, right? There are 120 Black people in philosophy. So the people that are going to be receptive to that kind of democracy, that kind of integration, the idea that really racism is just analogous to ruralness or urbanness. It's analogous to the misunderstanding that white men have to white women. It's completely not. White men have never tried to eliminate white women from the face of the earth. In fact, early feminists said that white women never had to worry about that because if the white race wants to persist and they want patriarchy to rise, they need white women to buy into white supremacy. This is your white feminist saying that. Right? There's never been a contradiction. There's never been a misunderstanding in any part of the Western world that white women are going to reproduce with white men because they keep choosing to do so. They're not eliminating the population. The kind of engagement, the misunderstanding that Anderson asks us to believe in is one where Black men disproportionately die and have the lowest life expectancy in the United States compared to every other group, right? One where Black men have the greatest level of downward mobility compared to white women and Black and white men. Where you can explain the wealth gap in the Black race compared to the white race in part because of the economic and income discrimination between white men and Black men. So what's the misunderstanding? You see, if the idea is we just need to understand each other, then you've overlooked the way that individual attitudes merely project institutional realities. It doesn't matter if all my friends were white. It doesn't change the way that the structure in society is organized. It doesn't decrease the rate of police killings of Black men, Right. You see, this is exactly what I mean. Right. Throughout Anderson's work, she appeals to terrible stereotypes about Black and brown men. And to this day, I didn't find one criticism about those stereotypes because everybody was focused on the integration part. The way that she defines racism is to say that we shouldn't talk about she argues against Charles Mills. Right. So, again, this is what I'm so fed. We're so interested in saying we should have a mutual understanding between parties. Poor people should understand rich people. Urban people should understand rural people. Right. But Charles Mills says, well, I think racism is white supremacy. In her book, she says, well, I don't think that we should call it white supremacy because that makes good liberal white people like me feel bad. We should reserve the notion of white supremacy for actual white supremacists because you don't want to alienate the liberal base. Now, do you, Charles? Now, does that sound like understanding? Because see, to me, that sounds like a hierarchical position in the discipline where a white liberal knows that they have power as a gatekeeper to decide which Black thinking and thought gets in and gets out. Because if it was about understanding, surely you wouldn't tell someone that's been oppressed by you and your group that they can't define terms in a certain way because it's offensive. It would alienate you politically and offend your sensibilities. You see, we don't want to pull the mask away from what philosophy actually is. And I don't know Elizabeth Anderson. I mean, I've heard she's a great person. So this isn't a personal attack. I'm directly responding to her scholarship. If the way that we think about race is about the relationship of understanding to one another, then how many white people have to understand Black people getting shot in the middle of the street before that inspires some sensibility of justice? How many times do we have to go through hiring meetings in departments where they say, well, yet again, we're hiring in race. We've decided we're going to hire another white woman. You see, because how do we measure the political imperatives that white women have, right, for their own inclusive democracy, which is overwhelmingly their representation, and the practical non-existence of Black, brown, and indigenous people in the field? This is where the rubber meets the road. This is not a misunderstanding. This is about a conflict, not only of values, but of aspiration. We can both say we value equality, and you can say, well, let's hire a white woman as a philosopher because that's more equal than a white man. But does that version of equality trump the fact that Black, brown, and indigenous men and women are practically non-represented in the field? Does your understanding of gender equality trump the fact that you don't want to hire a Black man because you think he's a man and not Black, despite your whole philosophy department being white? These are not misunderstandings. This is not ignorance. This is about pursuing an aspiration of the world that leaves a little less room, if not the complete, requires a complete absence of certain groups of people. And see, that's why racism is different than sexism, than homophobia, et cetera. Because nobody's exterminating these other groups to the extent that they've historically exterminated Black and brown and indigenous people. Black people pay with the road to civil rights with their lives. They're not killing white women on the street for Me Too. But they're shooting Black men in the street for defying cops, for protesting for civil rights. The discipline continually chooses to reward scholars that are interested in dealing with the gender question over the race question. Yet we're supposed to believe that philosophy is an anti-racist enterprise. Right. See, these are the hard questions that people don't want to ask or address to the discipline because it makes you unpopular. It sounds too radical. It's off-putting to white liberals. But even if we take the political question as an aside, why would we not care as a discipline about the intellectual foundations of how these demographic, you know, trends seem to keep happening and seeming to persist? Right. We're being intellectually dishonest about what we think is dealing with race and what we're willing to accept. And then we're trying to censure the kinds of intellectual traditions that would lead different scholars to ask these very questions that we don't want to answer.
So what is the way to coexist though? Because I mean, if just listening to one another isn't going to be enough because, you know, that's not, as you say, the main problem here, you know, it should be obvious by now. Mm-hmm. What is, given that we need to coexist, people of different colors and in the same state, in the same place, in the same departments, what's a way of doing that mm-hmm. better than the way we've been doing it so far?
Take away the ability of white people to harm people they don't like. So this is an issue of redistributing power. There are roughly 120, let's be generous, let's say 150 Black philosophers. That means that if you can find schools that hire 2 to 3 Black philosophers per department, you only need run a hand 50 schools to dedicate themselves to hiring Black people. You have full Black employment in the field. That shouldn't be difficult. Nobody thinks it's difficult hiring 3 women or 3 queer scholars are three white men, right? We have departments filling these people. So what is it that stops us from hiring three black people? When I was at Texas A&M, it was a fight to have more than one black person on Falcon, right? And then when it was reviewed, the idea is like, well, you have one black person, you're better than most departments in the country. Now think about that seriously for a moment. The idea is philosophy is racist because philosophy doesn't have more than 0 to 1 black faculty members in a department. You have one. So you look like other departments. It would logically follow you're therefore racist like the other departments in terms of representation, right? But we don't see it that way. We say good job. Now, could you imagine if someone said, don't worry, we have one woman in the department. We're okay on gender. You see, that's about the way that we prioritize and value different bodies because of skin color, right? It's about how we value the category. So if we want to solve the problem, then the issue is you have to give more power to black people in philosophy. And that means that senior black people should have more mobility. Senior black people should have resources. Senior black people's letters should actually matter, right? These are very concrete ways. Notice how this isn't just about getting along. This is about dealing with the problem. If the issue is you have black people that are constantly being pushed out of philosophy into teaching or liberal arts institutions, then hire black people at tier 1 and 2 research institutions. Well, that's hard to do. There's so many people out. Well, not really, because when you look at the representational distribution of people, if you hire 2 black people a year in a given field in 50 departments, you solve it. Now, how many departments are there in philosophy in the United States and the UK? Come on, you see what I'm saying? This is not a hard problem to solve. But the issue is there's a resistance to what it means for us all to get along. You don't have enough black people in philosophy not to get along. I mean, you could think about it. You can go through your whole career and at most never have to work with a black person, just see them at conferences, which is the problem, right? There are so few black philosophers, right? In the United States, there's like, what, 21, 22,000 black are white philosophers, right? Like 16,000 are white men, 7,000, 8,000 are white women. You know, I forgot what, you know, Norwich's numbers were, right? You're talking about thousands of people, right? And notice, that's not overall in the academy. Right. Because you got almost half the academy's white women. OK, so basically 1.1 or 2 million people in the American Academy are white men and women. Black people are 110,000. So you have the institutions to absorb the people. But the reality of the situation is that white people in the academy don't want to deal with black people, which is why they're comfortable with being 1 or 2% of the discipline in various disciplines. Right. So, no, the issue is not about getting along. It's not how we get along. The question is, how do we adjust a system and allocate resources to solve the inequalities that we're okay with, right? The question of getting along is too complacent, because what it says is you have a group of black people that are dissatisfied. They don't have any power because black people don't decide who get hired in philosophy departments. So how do they become okay with their situation? How do they become okay with their marginalization and their unemployment? And their inability to get jobs despite white departments hiring white people to study race and not other black people. Right. See, it's asking us to become OK with the status quo. And furthermore, it asks something much more insidious that I would think would just be abhorrent to the very practice of philosophy. It asks and demands that certain black people don't ask certain questions. It asks us to entertain hires about people who outrepresent us, be they white women or white men, et cetera, in various positions. And be okay with that because we know those positions aren't for us. We get hired to study race. They get hired to study Nietzsche or to do logic or machine learning, as if the only interests that black philosophers have are in fact about race and their own oppression.
Yeah.
So contrary to the good spirited query of how do we get along? I think that's the wrong approach for black philosophers to adopt in the 21st century. The question is, how do we form as an extremely small minority an impetus to redistribute power and resources that demands near full employment and access to tenure and institutional resources so that the job market and hiring practices are not determined by white liberals by the extent to which we confirm or deny their beliefs.
One question I wanted to ask, and maybe this is very naive, is like, where does critical race theory stand in relationship to this idea that is becoming maybe a bit more kind of popular, or at least kind of a broader understanding, even if superficially, that, you know, racism is a systemic problem, right? So the idea that racism isn't about individuals or individual attitudes, but it's about structures. It's about institutions and, you know, be it the police or a criminal justice system or, you know, philosophy departments, or the banking system. You know, the idea that those institutions are somehow inherently racist because of their histories or because of their structures, and therefore it's not really about, you know, as you said earlier, about sort of unconscious bias on the part of the people that populate them. So where does that thought stand in relationship to critical race theory?
Well, I think the realist variation of recognizing for what it is, which is a continuation of oppression and white supremacy, right? I mean, most of the were really pioneered in social psychology much earlier than when we picked them up, right? Like we're talking about the ways that certain cultural practices kind of formulate habits and behaviors, right? And that's not kind of an aha moment, you know? It's the same thing with microaggressions, right? That literature has been around for 20 and 30 years, you know, until it kind of takes off with, you know, microaggression theory and racial battle fatigue. So we've always known that racist environments create behaviors and psychological assaults on the oppressed groups of people. Here's the difference. I think critical race theory makes it very easy to identify that. Critical race theory is asking the same kind of questions that you got Clark asking about inferiority complexes, is asking, you know, how do we understand a human black person? You know, there's a lot of different things. I mean, if I just go through the works of Bell, right, you know, his quoting of Delaney and Douglas and Du Bois, he's asking this question about what it means for black people to sustain, not reclaim, but sustain humanity under enslavement and racial oppression. That's a vastly different question that I think is being asked in philosophy departments. So, like, let's look at Penn State's, you know, creation of critical philosophies of race. Think about this quite seriously. I rather like Robert Bernasconi's work because, you know, we both work in intellectual history. But there's not been a black thinker, a black philosopher, to have a field represented in their area of thought ever. And what I mean by that is you create critical philosophies of race is I think it's got like three articles in a journal, right? And that becomes the basis of how white people higher in the discipline. Black people have been working in the field. Like you can go back to the 1970s and see debates about Afro-American philosophy, et cetera. And, you know, debates by Richard R. Jones, by Cornel West, by John McClendon, trying to figure out what black philosophy is, what it does, Lou Outlaw, Leonard Harris, et cetera, going all the way back to the 1970s. Nobody advertises in the problems that they're surveying, right? You see, black people don't get to name anything. We don't get to name areas of thought. We have black existentialism, black existential phenomenology. There's no searches in that. You have Mills's racial contract. There's no searches in that. You see, but you come up, you name a journal critical philosophy of race, and suddenly something with three articles gets a whole field. So when you ask me what's the relationship between the racial realist origins of critical race theory and this kind of de-radicalization, it's the marketing. It's what people get to brand and name themselves after, and why white people, knowing that there's a whole history. I mean, think about the audacity of this. There's a whole history of critical race theory that reaches back all the way to the 1970s, arguably the 60s, but let's say the 1970s, where you actually have Derrick Bell and Rich Delgado writing about this as lawyers before the Madison Conference. You would say you don't need to know any of those thinkers or even that tradition, because as long as you're telling me the kind of Penn State version of critical philosophies of race and asking race questions from a plethora of ways, that suffices. You define what you do. There's no canon. There's no set of texts that we expect you to master. We just want you to come in and talk about race. And we start, and not only do we do that, we start hiring in that field. So you're telling me that black people, we're not, Afrocentricity has been around. It's a philosophical orientation. We don't hire in that. Critical race theory has been around. There was a brief resurgence around that in the early 2000s. Back when I got a job around 2008, 2009, there were some advertisements around that. But overwhelmingly now it's critical philosophies of race or Africana philosophy. Racial contract theory, no jobs. Black existentialism, no job. Black phenomenology, no jobs. You see the point I'm making. So how then do we understand the relationship between the version of critical race theory that white philosophers created and accepted, which largely evaluates the racism of other white people, and then the thought of black people and brown people? So the relationship precisely is that you've trained black people, you're rewarding black people for de-radicalizing their thought and focusing again, yet again, on white texts and white figures rather than black thought and theory. And I'll give you a very concrete example of how this plays out. A few years ago, when I was on the job market, I did an on-campus, an interview, where in the interview, I was, now mind you, I'm a full professor at this point, okay? I'm applying for this job. they're asking, well, your work, you say X. I was like, yes, my work in critical race theory deals with how Black people created specific genealogies to articulate, theorize, and interpret the permanence of racism. So then one white male from the search group is like, well, you don't think Western philosophy is interesting or that we can use critical philosophies of race, you know, kind of like what Bernie Scioto is saying, to dig into it. I was like, no, I don't. And I was like, let me ask you a question. I could do critical philosophy of race and never read a Black person, can't I? Because if I study the racism of Kant, of Voltaire, of, you know, Hegel, that's all critical philosophy of race. But that doesn't require me to actually know anything about the Black intellectual tradition, does it? He's like, well, surely there are resources in the Western metaphysical tradition to help you. I was like, as opposed to what? As opposed to African traditions, as opposed to Caribbean traditions, as opposed to indigenous traditions? I was like, why would you need me to confirm, right? If you're interested in this area, why do you need me to confirm some universal principle where the Western tradition has also been the birth of practically every genocide that we've had in the 20th century? Right? So notice the conformity there. I'm a full professor, and on the first round interview, that's the debate that they wanted to have. Not about my work, but why I didn't confirm their abstract thinking, even though, mind you, this is an area that they don't write it. It's the disposition, it's the authority that someone who's not a specialist in race or Black people or Africana thought can hold your feet to the fire and ground your reasoning. And you can tell me that even though I don't study this text, surely the Western tradition is a sacred creed of orientation where even though it creates the faults you identify with dehumanization, et cetera, it also has the solution, right? So this is the problem of orientation. This is the problem of why critical race theory requires that we have de-radicalized, more liberal, compatible, or idealistic versions.
What would be a book that you would recommend to listeners for understanding what critical race theory is and its origins?
I'm writing a book on the origins of Bell's political theory because I promised him before he died that I would write a book on him. But I think that you can really read a lot of the books by Gene Stefanchik and Richard Delgado. That I really like their historiography of critical race theory because they were both there, right? You know, Kenneth Nunn's work on critical race theory is founding. You know, and then of course my work. I mean, if you're interested in the history of disciplinary, you know, of just how it's come into philosophy, what the difference of debates and traditions are. I mean, God, I think I've published like 8 or 9 essays on this topic. So, you know, it's enough to be a book, but I just wrote it as essays. So yeah, I mean, that's where I would point people. I got to recommend Tim Golden just put out a reader in Derek Bell. I think it's going to come out on SUNY pretty soon. I wrote the foreword to it. So that would be a really good introduction for people just trying to get their feet wet in the next year or so with some of the debates in critical race theory. But again, the irony of that question is that in a discipline that claims that it's doing critical race theory, there isn't a definitive book or set of essays outside of the work of one or two people that's really trying to situate critical race theory as an intellectual and paradigmatic tradition and perspective in philosophy and the academy more broadly.
Do you know what the title of the book coming out of SUNY Press is going to be?
Called Racism and Resistance, Essays on Derek Bell's Racial Realism. It's a fantastic text that I had the pleasure of reading that's really trying to bring sort of thinking about Bell's work to the forefront. You know, and I think it's so important that critical race theory, you know, maintains its grounding. That doesn't mean we can't debate it. I think it would be awesome to have conferences on the meaning of Afro-Atlantica or, you know, can there be normative political thought under the permanence of racism? You know, these are all questions that I think are opened up by what, you know, first generation race crits were doing. But unfortunately, this is just not where we're at in the discipline of philosophy yet.
Tommy Carey, thank you very much.
No, thank you for having me.
Many thanks to the philosophers Anthony Morgan for researching this episode. Olive Richardson was the editor, and the music was by Rowan McElvright. If you enjoy listening to The Philosopher in the News, I have a favour to ask you. Please take a minute and leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. It will really help keep our audience growing and make it easier to book the best guests for the podcast in the future. I'm Alexis Papazoglou, and this was The Philosopher in the News. Speak again soon.